All right, so once again, my name's Sam. As you see, I'm Asian, and what you need to know is most Asians cannot swim. Almost every Asian has a near-death drowning experience. Almost every Asian will have a story where a well-meaning Aussie friend pushed them into a pool at a party, not knowing that they could not swim. And so when I went to primary school, I was the only kid in the whole school who could not swim. I was the only Asian in that class. And once a week, we had compulsory swimming lessons in the school swimming pool. And the swimming teacher did not know what to do with me. It was the first time she had a kid who could not swim in her class. So all she kept doing was yell at me, "Swim! Swim!" She didn't know how to teach someone who could not swim to swim. And I remember I would just drown and sink, and all she could do was yell, "Swim!" at me. And one time I sunk and swallowed and breathed in so much water, I just vomited my lunch back up into the pool. And so for the rest of the lesson, my lunch was doing laps around the pool, scaring all the other swimmers. If someone can't swim, there's no point yelling at them, "Swim!" If they could be swimming, they would be swimming. And it's the same with telling our friends about Jesus. Whenever we go to these things, it just feels bad. Someone's going to say, "You got to tell your friends about Jesus." And we're thinking, dude, if I knew how to do it, I would be doing it. And almost every sermon application, Bible study application is, "You got to tell your friends about Jesus." And it just feels awful because you think, oh, I would be doing it if I knew how to do it. And so what we're going to do today over the next few sessions is run a seminar on how to tell your friends about Jesus. And I'm going to share with you 6 tips that work for me. And I'm not saying they're perfect tips. I'm not saying they're silver bullet tips. Do this and it will work. I'm not saying they're the only way of telling your friends about Jesus, as in if you don't do it my way, you are wrong. No, I'm just saying, no, these are good ways. They're not great ways. They're not perfect ways. They're not the only way. They're not silver bullet ways. But these are good ways that have worked for me. And I'll share one half of the tips in the first hour in the how to tell your friends about Jesus, one half of the tips in the second hour, how to tell your own story, and then in the final session we'll have a Q&A session where you can brainstorm and ask me any questions on evangelism, and maybe together as a group we can brainstorm some answers. All right, so let's begin with the first tip on how to tell our friends about Jesus. And I'll write these on the board. So number one is, Get our friends to become their friends. Number one tip, get our friends to become their friends. Now imagine if I got up in front of you and said, "Oh, you won't believe what happened last night. My wife and I were kicking back in Sydney, and this UFO landed in our backyard. And this little green man got out, told us to come into the UFO, so my wife and I did, and we went with him to his home planet, Jupiter. We got out, he showed us around, we had a meal with his friends and family, we got back into the UFO, and because of the whole space-time continuum thing, we went through a time portal and only 1 second of Earth time went by and we were back in Sydney. Now, in this room full of 100 people, who here believes me?" Wow, no one, no one. Let me tell you another amazing story. 2,000 years ago, God sent us his son, Jesus, who was 100% God, 100% human at the same time, born of a virgin, and while he was alive as a grown-up, he raised dead girls back to life, he gave blind people their sight, and then he died on a cross. And if you believe this, God will take away all the sin and shame in your life. And he didn't stay dead. 3 days later, Jesus rose from the grave, and now he's in heaven in body form. If you believe this, his spirit will live in you right now, and one day in the future, depending on which denomination you belong to, Jesus will come again and he'll set up a kingdom, and you can be part of this kingdom forever. So who here in this room believes me? Wow. Almost everyone. Now you got to think, why are we happy to believe the Jesus story but not the Jupiter story? Because as I'm telling it, I'm thinking, you know, even the Jesus story, I'm not sure I believe it myself if you put it that way. And the Jupiter story is a lot more believable than the Jesus story. Why do we believe the Jesus story but not the Jupiter story? Because they both sound amazing, and let's face it, they're both pretty unbelievable. Well, it all comes down to what philosophers call plausibility structures. Plausibility structures. So, as I'm telling you my story, you're listening and you have these pre-programmed, predetermined plausibility structures that prejudge what you hear, and they will determine whether my story is believable, plausible, or not believable. So as I tell you the Jupiter story, last night a UFO landed in our backyard. Your predetermined, pre-programmed plausibility structures are prejudging my story as bam, bam, bam. You're redlining it. Implausible, implausible, implausible. And then we went to his home planet Jupiter. Bam, bam, bam. Red light, red light, red light. Implausible, implausible, implausible. And then we went through one of these space-time continuum time portal things, and only 1 second of Earth time went by. Bam, bam, bam. Red flag, red flag, red flag. Implausible, implausible, implausible. So you're red flagging everything I'm saying. You're choosing not to believe it. You're prejudging my story. But as I tell you the Jesus story, 2,000 years ago, there was a man called Jesus, born from a virgin. Your plausibility structures are green-lighting it. Bling, bling, bling. Plausible, plausible, plausible. He died on a cross, and this would take away all your sin and shame and guilt. Bling, bling, bling. Green light, green light, green light. Plausible, plausible, plausible. And one day he'll come again in bodily form. Bling, bling, bling. Plausible, plausible, plausible. Green light, green light, green light. You're choosing to believe it. Your predetermined, pre-programmed plausibility structures are prejudging my Jesus story as believable. Now, where do we get these plausibility structures from? Well, there are three main sources. The first source is community. The second source is experiences. And the third source is facts, evidence, and data. So as I'm telling you the Jupiter story, right now most of us do not belong in a community of people who believe in UFOs and aliens. As I tell you the Jupiter story, most of us have not had a personal experience of a UFO in our backyard. As I'm telling you the Jupiter story, most of us do not believe there are any facts, evidence, and data to support my UFO story. But as I tell you the Jesus story, most of us belong in a community of people that we know and love and trust who also believe in the Jesus story. As I tell you the Jesus story, most of us here have had a personal experience of Jesus. And as I tell you the Jesus story, most of us believe there are enough facts, evidence, and data to support the Jesus story. So that's why we're happy to believe the Jesus story, but not the Jupiter story. And out of these three sources, community, experiences, facts, evidence, and data, whether we like it or not, rightly or wrongly, the one that's most powerful is community, and the one that's least powerful is facts, evidence, and data. Whether we like it or not, rightly or wrongly, that's just how we form beliefs. So let's take facts, evidence, and data. If I was to say to you, the UFO is in my backyard right now in Sydney. Who here would make the 3-hour drive in the rain to check out the UFO? Well, it's a minority view, isn't it? 2 hands out of 100. Maybe 3 or 5 people who are too embarrassed to say they would check it out. But most of you think, there is no UFO. I'm not wasting my time checking it out. And if you were to come and see the UFO and see it and touch it and knock on it, you would be thinking, nah, there's another explanation for this. This is an elaborate hoax. Meaning, what we do is we choose not to check out the facts, evidence, and data, if it exists, and we explain away the facts, evidence, and data if we do see the facts, evidence and data. So the one that's most powerful, whether we like it or not, rightly or wrongly, is community. We do what people around us do, we think like people around us think, and we believe what the people around us believe, especially people that we know, trust and love. And so, for example, when my wife and I were expecting our second child, we had that game that all parents play. What do we name our child? Now, every parent thinks, okay, we don't want a name so common that's boring, like a Peter, John or Andrew. Boring. But we don't want a name so funky and edgy, like a Matthew with three T's and a silent Q. We want a name that's just right. Not too common, not too weird, but something that just shows, hey, look at this name, hey? Look how cool and edgy and trendy the parents are to pick this name. And so we went with Cooper. We named our son Cooper. We think, hey, it's not a John, Andrew, Peter. It's not a weird name. Just right. Look how cool we're going to be. And that year, when we named our son Cooper, Cooper was a top 10 name in Australia. We thought we were trying to do something edgy, but we're just doing what everyone around us was doing. That's how subtle community is in determining belief and practice. Now, in this room here, who here believes that women have a right to vote? Oh, okay, every hand up. Okay, the guys say, yep, that's me. But just think about it. This is a room full of Bible-believing Christians. All of us believe women have a right to vote. But 100 years ago, had we done this vote, none of us believed women had a right to vote in a room full of Bible-believing Christians. So somehow community is very powerful in determining what we believe and do. Who here believes that we have a right to public education? The government should pay for our education. Wow, all the uni students, hey? But all the taxpayers are going, come on, I'm not paying for you, freeloaders. But most of us believe this is a God-given right, public, government-paid education. Who here believes in the idea of public health? The government should pay for our health. We should have a safety net. Okay, majority opinion. But if I was to go to... Who here believes that motorcyclists should wear helmets? It should be mandatory by law. They should wear helmets. Majority opinion. Now, I lived 5 years in America. Have I gone to Texas in an equivalent Bible-believing church running this seminar? And I said, who here believes in the idea of public health and education? No one. Because this is my money. I work for it. Why should my money go to some freeloader who did not work hard for it? God gave me this money and I have the right to spend it how I want. And if I was to say, should motorcyclists wear helmets? Most of them would say, no, they have a right to choose what to do with their head. And they have an accident, unless they're paying for their health and I'm not paying for the hospital bill. So it's actually not a Bible-based decision. It's a community-based belief. Our ideas on education, health, and even motorcycle helmets. So community is very powerful in determining what we believe and do. Now imagine we came to this room and I said, last night, a UFO took me to the planet Jupiter and I'm the only one in this room that has a story. I'm the one schmuck who believes in UFOs and had the UFO experience. My story's going to come across as unbelievable in this room. But let's say you came here and as you walked in, this half of the room said, me too. I had a UFO in my backyard last night and I went to the planet Jupiter. I thought that was you I saw. I just wasn't sure. I didn't want to wave just in case I was wrong. And then now, how would you feel in this half of the room? You think, wow, half of the room have the same story. Now the story comes across as more believable. And let's imagine now you come in and everyone in the room has the same story and you're the one and only schmuck who didn't have the UFO story happen to you. Now the story comes across as a lot more believable. So what has this got to do with evangelism? Well, typically as Christians, we evangelize solo. We go out by ourselves as the one and only schmuck with the Jesus story. And so we think, oh, I've got to tell my friends about Jesus. So maybe I'll sign up for a football club, maybe a book club, maybe a cooking club. I'll play tennis. I'll meet some non-Christians and I can tell them about Jesus. And that's very good, but it's going to come across as very unbelievable, rightly or wrongly, whether we like it or not, because in a group of 20 people, we're the one schmuck with the Jesus story. So what we can do now is merge our universes. So get our friends, our Christian friends, to become friends with our non-Christian friends and merge our two universes. Because as Christians, we end up with two universes, a universe with Christian friends and universe with non-Christian friends. And so when our Christians go for barbecue, we go with them. When our non-Christians go for barbecue, we go with them. Our Christians go to a movie, we go with them. Our non-Christians go with a movie, we go along. But what we should proactively try to do is get our Christian friends to become friends with our non-Christian friends. So when our non-Christians have a barbecue, we bring our Christian friends along. When our Christian friends go up to the movies, we bring our non-Christian friends along. And bit by bit, we merge our universes so that our non-Christians can actually meet and know, love and trust a wider body of Christians besides just us. And it takes years to form trusted friendships. It takes about 2 years to form friendships with people that we know, love and trust. So this is actually a lifestyle change I'm arguing for. So typically, when we say, every year we make the same New Year's resolutions. This year, I've got to get fit. I've got to get fit. And so we try to tack fitness on into our lifestyle. Like, oh, okay, I'm going to get up early and go for a run once a week. Or I'm going to cut this out from my diet. So we just tack on things into our lifestyle. But as they always say, no, it has to be a lifestyle change if we want to get fit. We can't just add something into our program. And evangelism is the same. Typically we think, okay, I've got to tell my friends about Jesus. I'll tack something on into my life. Maybe I'll sign up for a tennis team. Or I'll work out a way to tell my friend about Jesus at this lunchtime. This lunchtime, I'm going to bring it up. Or we ask our church, you've got to run something evangelistic. You've got to have something on in the calendar. But what I'm arguing is we actually need a lifestyle change where our whole life becomes proactively evangelistic. And it begins with the way we make friends, and it begins with the way we try to merge our universes. And this is a time investment. I used to, when I was a single guy, I lived in an apartment with three other doctors. We all worked at the same hospital. I was the only Christian in the apartment with three non-Christian doctors. And so we used to go out a lot. But bit by bit, my church friends would often visit me, and so they would go out with all of us. And whenever my church friends went out, I would bring my non-Christian doctor friends along, and bit by bit, the universes merged. And sure enough, after 2 years, my three non-Christian friends became regular church attenders, and they would say they all gave their lives to Christ. But it took 2 years, but it took a merging of the universes as well. It wasn't just me trying to tell my three non-Christian friends about Jesus. And that means we can proactively do things to merge our universes. So if we're single, we can maybe think, okay, I'm going to look for non-Christian flatmates rather than church buddies to flat with. If we already have a home and a family, we can maybe try to have an international student in our spare room. The government even pays for the rent. All you've got to provide is a meal and internet. And now you have a non-Christian living in your Christian universe. But bit by bit, there are ways we can try to merge our universes. I'll give you another example. Our son's in an AFL team. And so on the sideline, the whole lot of parents. And at the end of the year, we had a barbecue. And I knew there were two or three other Christian families. And we invited two or three other non-Christian families, and we're trying to merge the universes, get these Christians to become friends with the non-Christians and the other way around. So that's the first tip. Understand how powerful community is in determining what we believe. So the Jesus story is true. I'm not talking about the truth status. I'm talking about the believability status. It is true, but we can make it more believable if we can introduce our non-Christian friends into a community of people that they know, love and trust about Jesus. So that's my number one tip. Merge our universes and get our friends to become their friends. Number two, I'm going to call it the... You got to go to their things before they come to your things. Go to their things before they come to your things. So I often get invited by churches and Christians to deliver a 20-minute gospel presentation in various forms. And there's a friend of mine called Andrew who's always organising these things. And whenever I turn up to do my talk, I've always noticed Andrew is surrounded by four non-Christian friends, And they're different friends every time, so he's got a big non-Christian universe. And they're happy to be there. I can see in the body language, they are so happy to be there. They love listening to my talk about Jesus. They're not Christians. Afterwards, they always come up to me. They ask me questions. They talk. You can tell they've had a great night. So I went to Andrew's wife, Jackie. I said, you've got to tell me Andrew's secret. How does he get so many of his non-Christian friends to come to these Christian events? And why are they always happy to be there anyway? And his wife, Jackie, said, oh, it's easy. We're always going to their things. We're always hanging out anyway. This is just one of many things we do together. And see, that's a key. If we never hang out with our non-Christian friends, and then our church says, hey, we've got this thing you've got to invite your friends to, and usually for men it's a breakfast, it's an evangelistic breakfast, and think, oh, when do men do breakfast together anyway? But now I've got to invite my non-Christian friends to a breakfast, and it's a Christian thing anyway. You think, oh, how do I do this? And your non-Christian friends are thinking the same thing. Oh no, here he comes. You know what he's going to do? He's going to try and invite us to one of these church breakfast things. Oh no, here he comes. But the point is, if you're always hanging out anyway, if you're going to their things, this is just one of many things you do together. And it will just feel natural, not forced, and it doesn't have to be a good time anyway. The whole point is this is what you would normally do. And so what we can do proactively then is go to their things. And so across the street, well, okay, I'll share that a bit later maybe, but you know, if their kids have a concert at school, go to the concert. If their kids have a graduation, go to the concert. If they're in a band and the band is playing, go and listen to them in the band. If their kids in some race, go and listen to the race. If they have a movie night, go to the movie night. If whatever they're doing or putting on, go to their things. They will notice, they'll appreciate, and bit by bit they come to your things, and you hang out all the time anyway. So a few years ago, my kids got into an AFL thing on a Saturday. Saturday sports are very important. It's how you make community. It's how you build social capital. But I remember when I was a kid, your parents just dropped you off at training and they went somewhere else. Somehow now parents expect to hang around on the sideline for the whole of Wednesday night in the cold and rain. They're meant to run water. They're meant to pick up the stray footballs. And I think, when did this happen? And on Saturday, you're on some roster. You got to run the barbecue. You got to bring the snacks. You think, when did this happen? I thought I could just drop my kids off, read the newspaper, have a coffee, and then come back. And suddenly I said, no, this is a community thing now. And I shared my frustration with another Christian friend. He goes, yeah, and this is your best way of building a community. He said, bit by bit, if you do this, you become a known, trusted member of their community, of their football, Saturday sports community. And bit by bit, you actually become the de facto chaplain. Bit by bit. But the more involved you are in their things, the more they will come to your things. So that when you do have the barbecue, they do come to your barbecue because you've been going to their things. And I said to my friend, you know, it was so funny because I was so hoping I could just drop them off, go sit up on the hill with my newspaper and coffee. He said, here on the sideline. And my friend said, yeah, at his Saturday sport thing, there is a guy who sits up on the hill with his coffee and his newspaper and everyone notices him. Oh, look at that guy. You know, and it's actually their local church minister. He's the one that sits up there. But anyway, that's another story. And it's not Canberra. That's a different city in Sydney anyway. So you don't know this guy. But that's my second tip. We got to go to their things before they come to our things. And then whenever we try to invite them to an evangelistic thing, it's just one of many things we would do together anyway. And then you don't have so many things invested. I'll share another story. So a few years ago, while we're on point two, go to their things. So a few years ago, while I live on a street, almost everyone there is Italian Catholic. And so on Christmas Eve, they went to their local church mass for midnight mass. And so I actually said, can I come along? And they looked at me like, you want to come along? I said, yeah, sure, can I come along? So I went to midnight mass with them. And in the car on the way home with all my neighbours, they said, well, what do you do for Christmas? Oh, I said, well, funny enough, I give the Christmas talk on Christmas. Would you like to come? And they said, yes. And so for the next 3 or 4 years, they've been coming to our Christmas events. Again, if we go to their things, they will come to our things. And the funny thing with Italian Catholics is, because Christmas is compulsory, right? It's like compulsory voting for us. You're looking for the place with the shortest queue. And so when they said, okay, they'd never been to a Protestant Christmas service. And they said, how long will your service be? And I said, it'll be 60 minutes. I said, come on, will it be 60 minutes? Yeah, I promise, I guarantee it'll be 60 minutes. So for them is, how short will your service be? Because again, it's like compulsory voting. You just want the shortest queue. You've done it, tick. You've done the box. All right, so number three is what I call the coffee dinner gospel sequence. Coffee dinner gospel sequence. Now, typically, when we think, oh, I've got to tell my friends about Jesus, how do I bring up Jesus? How do I do that? Well, maybe we just take baby steps and break it down into smaller steps. Just go the coffee dinner gospel sequence instead. We're not trying to tell our friends about Jesus, we just want to do coffee with them. And if we do coffee with them often enough, sooner or later, we can do dinner with them. And then we can do dinner with them often enough, sooner or later conversations will drift towards religion and worldviews. And then we can actually start talking about Jesus. See, coffee is an easy invite because they're only investing 20, 30 minutes. That's what a coffee invite is. It's 20 or 30 minutes, it'll be quick. It's in public space, so we're only going to talk about public safe things like, whoa, how's that weather, hey? Well, how about them Bulldogs on the weekend? Whoa, what movie did you watch on the weekend? What did you do? So that's really safe conversation. And people are happy, they're not investing much time, and it's just going to be a safe time together. But bit by bit, if you do that often enough, then it can merge to dinner. And dinner becomes more private space. And now you're investing 1 to 2 hours. And conversations now drift tend towards more meaningful things. So they're actually layers of conversation. So I'll draw this concentric circle thing. I actually learned this from Peter Ritchie from Focus Ministries to the Armed Forces in Canberra. So Peter Ritchie from Canberra taught me this. There are three layers to conversation. Usually you begin with interests. Then you go values. Then you go worldviews. Interests, values, worldviews. So when you're having coffee, you're actually having interest conversations. Did you do anything interesting on the weekend? Yeah, we had a picnic. Yeah, we watched some sport. Yeah, I read a book. Yeah, I slept in. So that's just what interests you. But bit by bit, as you do dinner, you're going to have to touch on values a bit more. What do you like? What do you prefer? What do you think is good? What do you think is wrong with this world? And then you drift towards more of those things. And bit by bit, the more and more you have value conversations, you're going to drift towards worldview sort of conversations. And that's when you can actually bring up things like the gospel. And I'll share some of this with you now, and maybe we can talk about more of this during Q&A. I remember a chaplain telling me that what happens is after a while in interest, people will invite you into value type conversations. And so they might bring up something and you've got to be actively listening. Oh, they're inviting me into a value conversation. And then bit by bit here, they might then, if they feel safe enough, they say something that which shows they're trying to invite you into a worldview thing. So you're actually trying to listen for the permission to go one layer in. And this chaplain told me, people will actually give you three goes at it. They'll throw the hint out once. Then they'll throw the hint out twice. Then they'll throw the hint out a third time. And if you don't pick it up on the third time, they retreat back out here. Okay, this guy doesn't want to talk about it, or he's not listening. He's not hearing me. And so then you miss the choice, chance to go one deeper. And we can talk more about that during Q&A time. So that's actually what's happening. Coffee, you're here. Dinner, you're drifting into here. And bit by bit, if you're dinner enough, you're in there. So I live in a street where on Friday afternoons, for some reason, every guy is in the front yard watering their lawn, handheld, right? Shh. And I think it's just a safe place for guys to be because now it gets you out of, you know, bathing the kids, getting them ready for bed. Hey, I've got to water the lawn. It's very dry, it's very hot. We've all got to water the lawn. So we're all out the front watering our lawn. And I didn't invent this. My neighbours actually came up with this. And then you bring out some beers with you. And then you start sharing the beer. So what we're doing is coffee here, aren't we? So we're in public space, having safe talk, watering the lawn. Hey, what are your plans for the weekend? And bit by bit, everyone gets together and we're all having a few drinks together on the front lawn. And people, the wives come out, hey, what's going on? And then that's when the wines come out. And then bit by bit, we go, no one feels like dinner now. And so I say, hey, what do you reckon? Come back to our place for some pizzas. So we invite everyone into our place and we order just cheap Domino's pizza. And that means everyone just has to throw in $5 or $10 to cover the cost. There's no cooking to show off. And so it's easy for people to reciprocate the next one. They don't have to match the meal that you just put on. There's no washing up, so dinner becomes really easy. And then people now stay for a long time. And then bit by bit, you become someone that they know and trust, and you enter the community. And so bit by bit, you start having worldview conversations because you've drifted from coffee, dinner, into the gospel. And you go think, well, why do we do this sequence? Well, let me explain what happened in the Western world. In the 1600s, in the West, we had a movement called the Enlightenment. And a prominent German philosopher called Immanuel Kant, he divided the whole world that we know into two realms, two spheres of knowledge. So we had the noumenal realm, that's one sphere of knowledge, the noumenal realm. And then we have the phenomenal realm, the phenomenal sphere of knowledge. In the noumenal realm is what we know about God, values, and ethics. In the phenomenal realm is what we know about facts, evidence, and data. Things that we can see and touch. So in the noumenal realm is what we believe about God and what we know about God. Values, as in chocolate is better than vanilla, rugby league is better than rugby union. In the ethical realm is what we believe is right and wrong. Abortion is right, no, abortion is wrong. In the phenomenal realm is what we can see, touch, and prove with logic and science. So the sky is blue, water boils at 100 degrees Celsius, that sort of stuff. And according to Immanuel Kant and the 1600s Western Enlightenment movement, it's not this realm doesn't exist. The noumenal realm does exist. It's just that we can't access it. So we can't verify it. We can't prove it. So we're always going to disagree on anything in this realm. So if I'm going to say there's a God, you're going to say, no, there's no God. And there's no way I can prove to you there's a God. If I believe rugby union is better than rugby league, you might have the opposite view. No, rugby league is better than rugby union. If you say chocolate is better than vanilla, you say no, vanilla is better than chocolate. Rom-coms are better than action. Action is better than rom-coms. How do we prove it? Like, how do you prove that sort of value statement? If I say abortion is right and you say no, abortion is wrong, now we're going to disagree. So according to these guys, this realm we cannot verify. We have no access to it. It might exist, but we cannot access it. Whereas this realm is easy to access, easy to prove. The sky is blue. Yes, it is. It's raining right now. Yes, it is. What did you do on the weekend? We had a picnic. I can't disagree. No, you did not have a picnic. It's raining. No, it's not raining right now. Water boils at 100 degrees Celsius. No, it doesn't. So we don't have fights in this area, but we have fights in this area because we're always going to disagree. And so ever since the 1600s, what we've done in the West is we've divided our whole world into the noumenal versus the phenomenal realm, or this is the private realm and this is the public realm, because we should talk about these things in public when we're not going to disagree. You can have whatever views you want about God and James Bond and rugby union in private, whatever your views are on abortion in private, but don't impose them on us in the public, because we cannot verify whatever you believe here. So that belongs in the private sphere. So this is the sacred, and this is the secular. So what we've had now in the West is this hang-up between the private and the public, the noumenal phenomenon, and the sacred and the secular. And this doesn't exist in the non-Western world. This is a very Western phenomenon. And so, let's say I was to say, hey, why are we in a church right now? why don't we just go on the main street of Canberra and we could have a prayer meeting, an open-air prayer meeting on the main street of Canberra, and I'll mention God and Jesus and how we can tell our friends about Jesus. Who here would come to an open-air public meeting, prayer meeting, on a main street of Canberra with me right now? All right, well, but it's a minority view, Most of us think, oh, we're not comfortable about that. Well, that's our Western culture. It's our Western hang-up. We've been taught to feel this way because the non-Western world doesn't feel this way. So if you go to a Chinese restaurant, they'll always have a shrine set up to their god in a public restaurant. They don't have a hang-up about worshipping their god in public. If you catch a taxi and your driver's Muslim, they have no problem talking about their god. If you go to the news agent, the Asian person serving you has no problem talking about their god. You mention God, they don't go, "Wow, dude, back off, you're violating my sacred secular divide here." No, it's perfectly normal. They don't have this split universe that we have in the West. So what we've inherited from the 1600s Enlightenment is what I call an unofficial closed country. So we have official closed countries, but actually Australia is an unofficial closed country. Like it or not, rightly or wrongly, we're actually an unofficial closed country. So there are ways we can work against that, but what I'm proposing here are ways that we can work with it. These are ways we can work in an unofficial closed country. And the coffee dinner gospel thing is what lets us work in this sequence. Because coffee is public space, and bit by bit, you're getting people into private space where these conversations naturally, organically happen. So my wife and I have a lot of non-Christian universes that we're investing in. We have our Saturday sport non-Christian universe, AFL on a Saturday. We have our swimming lesson universe. And we have the, I don't know what we call it, the childcare, the mother's kids club. What's the word for it? What's the childcare? So there's a childcare universe that we're in, where parents, after they drop off their kids, they can hang out in a church building and watch their kids, their younger kids play. So what's it called? Parent group?
Playgroup,
that's the word. So we have a playgroup. So we have AFL swimming playgroup, and we're investing in all of these, but we find it's very hard to tell our friends about Jesus, because at AFL, everyone's on the sideline, we're watching the game, and then the game, everyone disappears. Swimming, it's only half an hour, it's loud, it's awful in there, and after the lesson, everyone disappears. But the playgroup culture, the parents have dropped the kids off, now they sit in the church building at 10 a.m, they have a coffee, their kids are leaving them alone, it's very peaceful. And then when it's over, my wife says, "Hey, do you want to come back to my place for another coffee?" And so everyone comes back to our place for a coffee. And then it's lunchtime, and my wife says, "Hey, do you want to stay for lunch?" We'll just get some takeaway. So they stay for lunch. I come back from work at 5 p.m, they're still there. And then they're having another coffee, and then it's like, "Hey, you may as well stay for dinner." So we've done coffee, dinner, gospel, like, in a 12-hour period. And that's the one that's bearing the most fruit. That's the one we're finding where people are coming to know Jesus, getting baptized, making a decision. Because that's the one where we're actually getting people into private space. And bit by bit, the AFL culture, we're getting people into our private space because we're bringing them back to our place for barbecues. And they have been coming to our guest services at church as well. Again, we've been going to their things, they come to our things. But also they've been with us in private. So people being with you in private, they're much more likely now to come to one of our public church events as well. So that's a coffee, dinner, gospel sequence. Number four, we need to listen to their story. Listen to their story. So often I'm at a party or something where I don't know people, you know, and the music's pumping, doom, 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 that sort of thing. And then the conversation, "What do you do for work?" And I say, you know, "I'm an engineer." "Oh, that's good." And then they reciprocate, "What do you do for work?" And then I say, "I work for City Bible Forum, giving talks about Jesus." You know, the music stops, it's quiet, it's awkward now. You think, "Wow, what has just happened?" Well, we were in a public party having a good time. We were in the phenomenal public secular realm, making safe conversation. You know, boy, how blue is the sky? No, it's raining right now. What did you do on the weekend? How about them Bulldogs? What did you do for work? You're not going to disagree. I'm an engineer. No, you're not. No, this is all safe talk. And then, well, what do you do for work? I tell people about Jesus from the Bible. You have dragged them, kicking and screaming, into the numinal, sacred, private realm way before they were ready for that in the relationship. Now you brought up things that we can disagree about. And so now it's awkward, there's silence, it's a game of chicken, who's going to blink first? And finally someone says, whoa, how about them Bulldogs on the weekend? Yeah, how about them Bulldogs? And phew, we can talk about the weather again. Boy, it's been raining a lot. Yeah, it's been raining a lot. And then we're over here. But every now and then I like to play. So we're over here, and I say, okay, we're here way before we're ready for this in the relationship. I give them permission to stay there if they feel safe. I say, well, do you have a faith? And it's actually quite a safe question, because most surveys show 2 out of 3 Australians, in older generations, 4 out of 5 Australians actually believe in a supernatural God and life after death. It's actually a majority belief in Australia. It's just that we live in an unofficial closed country, so no one else just like us feels safe talking about this in public. So it's a very private belief that people have out there. Everyone actually has a belief in a supernatural God, and they believe in prayer, they pray, and they believe in life after death. They've just never felt safe talking about that. So now we're going to give them permission to feel safe and talk about it. Do you have a faith? And that's when you try to listen and hear and understand as much about their position as possible. And so one time I met a lady, she said, yeah, I'm a Buddhist. And I went, wow. Tell me about Buddhism. Because whatever people practice is not what you read in the books. So this is your chance to understand as much about their belief system as possible. Tell me about Buddhism. And then I asked, how do you pray? What do you do when you go to the temple? What are your dreams for your children? Is your partner a Buddhist? And she says, no, he's not a Buddhist. Well, how does that work, being a partner with a non-Buddhist? And then I asked questions like, how did you become a Buddhist? Were you always a Buddhist? She said, no, I wasn't always a Buddhist. Wow, were your parents Buddhist? No, they weren't. How did you become a Buddhist? Tell me about your journey. So you're actually trying to hear them, understand them. Because don't think you know everything about their faith position. You don't. And try to empathize. Feel what they're feeling. What is so attractive about this faith position? Why would they want to be a Buddhist? So you're not trying to think of, how do I disagree? How do I answer this? No, no, no. You're trying to hear their story. Hear them. Ask questions for clarification so you can understand. And actually go even one step further. Feel them. Why would they want to be Buddhist? Why would you want to be Buddhist? What's so attractive? What is the existential drive that is being fulfilled here? And if you meet an atheist, that's all right. You know, tell me about your faith position. They go, I'm an atheist. Wow! Tell me about that. Tell me about the God you don't believe in. Or something like that. And they may even say something like, oh, you know, and you say, were you an atheist all your life? Yeah, I grew up in an atheist family. Both my parents were atheists. I knew about atheism for as long as I can remember. But I had to make a decision for myself at the age of 16. I had to check it out. And I'm only joking. But it's just to show that atheism itself is a faith-based position. And so you go, wow, you want to hear about atheism. You want to understand atheism. And you want to empathize. Why would you not want a God? Why would you not believe in God? And you get them talking and talking as long as you can. And you know, if someone asks you, what did you do? If you ask someone, what did they do on the weekend? And you let them go for a minute, sooner or later, what are they meant to do in polite conversation? Reciprocate. What did you do on the weekend? And if you let them go for a minute, they should give you a minute. If you let them go for 10 minutes, they should give you 10 minutes. And that's what you're trying to play as well. Let them go for as long as you can, because sooner or later they will need to reciprocate if it's polite conversation. Well, tell me about your faith. And if you let them go for 1 minute without interrupting, they should give you 1 minute. If you gave them 10 minutes where you heard them, understood, empathized with them, nodded your head, go, wow, wow. They should give you 10 minutes where they hear, understand, empathize you with you without trying to interrupt you and argue with you. Now, I've started giving this talk a few places now, and just 2 years ago, I was asked to give this seminar in Adelaide at night time in front of 200 people. But I was in Sydney and I catch like a 4 p.m. flight, get off at Adelaide at like 6 p.m. and at 7 p.m. I'm in front of 200 people. I'm actually an introvert. I'm a loud introvert. But if I've had public time, and I love public time, I love public time, but I need a corresponding amount of private, quiet time, like a corner in a dark, dark, dark room to prepare or recover from public time. So I'm thinking, oh man, as I'm jumping on this plane in Sydney, in just 3 hours, I'm going to be in front of 200 people. I need just some quiet, private space. So as I sat down on the plane, before I could get the headphones in, which is the international symbol for do not talk to me, the man next to me tries to talk to me. I think, oh, please don't, please don't. But he starts talking to me and he says, are you going to LA for work or play? I said, work. Oh, what are you doing? I'm giving a talk. And I went, oh, okay, I should reciprocate. Well, why are you going to Adelaide, work or play? Well, he said, I've just finished giving a talk in Sydney. Oh, okay, what's your talk on? He said, oh, I was teaching doctors, postgraduate doctors, about the physics behind MRI machines. And I thought, oh, I can't believe it. 20 years ago, I did that course. Now we have something in common. Oh. And then he goes, well, what's your talk on? I said, oh, I can't believe this is happening. Okay, I'm giving a talk from the Bible about Jesus. And then there's silence. I went, oh, I can't believe it. I'm about to go to Adelaide and tell people what to do when this exact moment happens. I'll be such a hypocrite if I don't do it. So I said to him, well, do you have a faith? And that's when he said, well, when he was young, growing up in South Africa, he did. He checked out Christianity. But that's when, as a teenager, he found out it was a front for hate crimes against gay people. So I said, wow, tell me about that. Tell me about this journey. But did you always believe this? And so I let him go on for the next 90 minutes in this monologue where I kept asking for clarification. Oh, please explain, what do you mean by that? Oh man, I hear you, I understand you. Everything they teach you, marriage counselling, I hear you, I understand you, I feel you. Oh, I feel you, I feel you. And then he raised all these objections, you know, all religions are the same anyway. Science has disproved Christianity and it's a front for hate crimes against gay people. And I let him go on and on and on for 90 minutes on his flight. And I never interrupted him, never tried to argue, never tried to counter anything said. I just went through this whole thing. I just want to hear you. I want to understand you. I want to feel where you're coming from. And then there was silence. And then I said, oh, well, you've talked for quite some time. From what I hear you saying, from what I understand you saying, from what I feel from what you're saying, these are things you've said. And these are your three main objections. All religions are the same. Science has proved Christianity. And Christianity is homophobic. Am I right? He goes, yeah, that is, you have heard me. Then I said, well, would you like to hear from me then? And he went, yes. So then, because there's only 30 minutes left on the flight, he let me have the next 30 minutes uninterrupted monologue where I addressed each and every one of his concerns in a very empathetic, sensitive way. And when the plane landed, it was very pleasant. We swapped details. And he said, thank you so much for that conversation. You made the plane ride go so quickly. I think, oh, not for me. That's it. But often we're trying to worry about what to say. But really, all we have to do is, how can I be a better listener? How can I understand where they're coming from? How can I feel the emotions for what they're feeling? And then that gives us actually an advantage. They should sometime reciprocate, give us the same courtesy, and also we know where they're coming from now. Like, until then, if someone just says they're Buddhist, you don't know what that means. Or if someone says, yeah, I checked out Christianity as a South African, you don't know what that means. But now you have a much better idea where they're coming from. You're not going to come in blind. You have a much better way of shaping your answer. I remember my friend Jonathan Dykes, who gives a lot of public talks, and he got invited to give a talk to rebut Dawkins' book and also the Da Vinci Code book. And so he had to give a 20-minute talk rebutting these books. And I said to him, you know, these books, actually both of them philosophically, are very simple books. They're actually very, very easy to shoot down. And even atheists are quite embarrassed about both these books, as in they're very simplistic arguments. In the same way, us Christians might be very embarrassed by some Christian public speakers who are very simplistic. Dawkins and the Da Vinci Code are that sort of level. Very simple, very easy to shoot down. But I said to Jonathan, you know what? There's still top 10 bestsellers in New York, London and Sydney. Somehow people want these books to be true. So until we've heard, understood and haven't felt what's going on behind these books, why would I want the Da Vinci Code to be true? Why would I want Dawkins to be true? Until we address that, there's no point really rebutting the surface part of the argument. It's the same. If we're going to share about Jesus, we need to hear their story first. All right, so what have we done in this first hour? I've shared with you four tips. Good tips, not great tips, not perfect tips, not super silver bullet tips, not the only way to do it, but good tips that are working for me in my life right now. Number one, lifestyle change. Merge our universes. Get our friends to become friends with their friends. Number two was go to their things before they come to our things. Number three, coffee, dinner, gospel sequence. And then number four, listen to their story first. And then in the next hour, I'll share with you the final two tips.